Welcome back to the program. We're now 6 years out from the 2008 financial crisis, arguably long enough to take a long and nuanced view of what really caused it, what the impact has been, and what we should be doing as a result. Our memories generally are short, and our analysis usually simplistic. Ask most people and they'll tell you the housing bubble or greedy bankers. The facts, though, tell a different story. The complexity of the global financial system, macroeconomics, financial innovation, and the worldwide free flow of capital all played key roles. Martin Wolf, the chief economic commentator of the Financial Times, now takes a look back and forward at the crisis in his new book, The Shifts and the Shocks, What We've Learned and Have Still to Learn from the Financial Crisis. Martin Wolf, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure.
It's great to have you here. Starting at the present kind of and working our way back, one of the things that you point out is that we are far from out of the woods yet, that many of the inherent problems that created the 2008 financial crisis are things that are, A, still with us, and that some of the financial reforms that we put in place after the crisis in many ways froze kind of old paradigms, old ways of doing things. Talk a little about that first, Martin.
Okay, well, that's a very, very important point. And let me divide it into two parts so they are related. The first is where our economies are, and the second where our financial system is. When economies, we have to recognize that our economies have been massively damaged. One very simple way of thinking about this is to compare how much output we're producing today in the major economies of the West with how much sort of everybody basically expected us to be producing now 10 years ago. And so if you look at that, roughly speaking, economic output, it varies a bit by country, but say in the US or the UK, is about a sixth lower, more than 15% actually lower than we expected it to be. So we've had an enormous loss of GDP. We've had generally big rises in unemployment in many countries, and where we haven't had those, we've had long periods of stagnant or even falling real wages. So the losses have been dramatic, and I'm not even taking into account the destruction, the value of housing, the number of people who've lost their homes. So it's been a colossally costly crisis, and the costs are still with us. No country, it is extraordinary, no, and I mean no significant country of the big countries of the world has managed to get back to the growth rate of their economies, which they expected as normal before the crisis. And furthermore, even more worrying, 6 years after the crisis, the central banks are still operating universally, a policy of free money, and we're still not really booming. So this suggests that our economies have been very, very deeply hurt. To understand that in economic terms, I think one has to recognize that the forces that drove the crisis included essentially unsustainable global patterns of demand growth, unsustainable increases in leverage, and unsustainable rises in asset prices. And as we're adjusting painfully and slowly to the fact that these things were unsustainable, we have not found alternative ways of generating demand, generating growth, which works for our economies, for any of our economies. So the whole Western world is in this slump. It's a matter of degree. So that's the sense in which we're not out of the woods, very clearly not out of the woods. I like to say that I will be confident that we're out of the woods when our economies are all growing at least at previous trend rates, and the short-term rates of our central banks are back in normal territory, 3-4% or so. And we're nowhere near that. And then on the financial sector, well, my book points out that essentially what we've done is try to recreate the old financial sector, doing more or less the same things, but somewhat more safely. And we're doing that with somewhat more equity, not vastly more, but somewhat more, enormously much more regulation than before. So a tremendous amount of regulatory oversight. But the financial system is just as globally intertwined as before. It's just as complicated as before, and it's actually even more dominated than before by a relatively small number of gigantic financial firms, not just, of course, Americans, but also Europeans too. Also one or two Japanese, and of course in the future Chinese. But essentially, we are dominated by firms, and I think it is correct to say that these firms are too big to fail even now. We haven't really fixed that. So if you take these things together, you have to say that we've had this huge disaster. There's no way, other way of describing it. And nobody can possibly say with a straight face that we put it behind us. It's just history. We're still living with it.
When we look at what those predicted growth rates were prior to the financial crisis in 2008, and given the system they were operating in, is it arguable that those projections at that time and the growth rates that were expected at that time were unrealistic and unsustainable given the inherent nature of the system that we were operating in?
I think that's a very deep question, which I discuss in my book. But I don't think we have a definitive answer. But I think there's something very, very important to say here, which most people who make this argument don't recognize. When I say that we're far below trend rates of growth, I don't just mean the trends of, say, 2000 to 2007. I mean much longer-term trends, trends in the U.S. case that go back to the immediate post-war period. The same is more or less true in the case of the UK. So I'm not trying to suggest, by the way, that there haven't been changes in growth rates of that period. Of course, US growth in the 50s and 60s was significantly higher than subsequently. But the truth is that the shortfalls we are now seeing in growth, where we are today, has put us on a completely different path from the path that, say, the US or the UK have been on for decades. So if it is true that pattern was unsustainable, then we have to say, and it's really quite a significant statement, that contrary to our belief, particularly in the US, but not exclusively, in this brave new technological era, the brave new growth rates of a more open globalized economy, actually, the underlying growth rates, the true underlying growth rates of our economies, were slowing in all these decades. The growth we thought we were having was illusory. Now, I'm not prepared to accept that on the supply side, at least in terms of supply potential, that there's really anything that would explain why that should have happened. But it's certainly what you have to believe if you're saying it's unsustainable. I think there is another aspect, as it were, the demand side, which many economists and commentators, I think particularly in the US, are reluctant to accept. But I think Larry Summers rightly pointed out with his secular stagnation thesis, very close to my heart, sort of view I held before, but he got the right phrase. What I think we have to say is that from the late 90s onwards, maybe the mid to late 90s, we've had a chronic problem with the deficiency of demand in the world system, which has affected our economies. And there, I think, it is clearer to see why it was unsustainable. What were those causes of this deficiency of demand? The first was shifts in the pattern of saving surpluses in the emerging world. It's a big theme of mine, the rise of the global imbalances, which are demand subtracting. They subtract demand from the developed world, notably the US. Then there's been adverse shifts in the distribution of income. There have been a whole host of factors there, but I think it's impossible to look at that and not think that's weakened the potential for demand without rapid and unsustainable credit growth, which is associated with house price booms. So again, that is clearly unsustainable. The growth, the long period in the US and the UK, in fact, in which consumption grew faster than personal income, and when people were essentially saving nothing, that wasn't sustainable. And finally, corporations, for a whole host of reasons, which I think include failures of corporate governance, the wrong way of incentivizing managers, and also changes in the returns they see. They've been investing very weakly. We've had an extraordinarily weak investment behavior by Western corporations. So I would say, yes, there was something unsustainable, but the unsustainability more and more clearly looks like a demand problem. And then you have to ask yourself, which of course I do, is how you might be able to fix this. But anyway, I think the question is absolutely central to our understanding of what's been happening. But I can't believe that we just sort of lost the ability to grow. I can't see why, because we're seeing so much innovation out there. But I think we've lost the ability to demand what is we are capable of producing. And that is shown by this very prolonged period of ultra expansionary monetary policy, which is not doing anything because nobody wants to spend.
And that really goes to one of your key points, which is this knee-jerk reaction that came following the crisis with respect to austerity, and the need for austerity was arguably exactly the wrong solution.
Yes, I think it was a profound analytical error. I thought it at the time, a political error, but the analytical error comes first in a way, people, and it was even worse in Europe than it in Europe than it was in the U.S. The U.S. was not quite so foolish, but my view was very simple, and I started writing this already in late 2008. We were entering into what the Japanese economist with the Chinese name Richard Koo calls a balance sheet recession because of these excesses, which were what drove demand effectively up to 2007, particularly in economies like yours, but also in a number of others, the UK, Spain, places like this, we had accumulated gigantic quantities of debt, particularly in the household sector, though not exclusively. Because asset prices were falling, particularly house prices, and this debt was no longer sustainable, people had either to go bankrupt or they had to pay it down. This is a balance sheet recession. It means that suddenly people who are highly indebted, and there were so many of them at that time, had to stop spending. And they couldn't borrow anyway because the financial system was no longer willing to take the risk. So there was bound to be, inevitably going to be, a huge deficiency of household demand, which, remember, in the U.S. accounts for about household consumption, about 70% of total demand. So somewhere this had to be offset. If it wasn't going to be offset, there was going to be this gigantic slump. And indeed, that started in 2008-09. There were really only two possible places where additional demand could come from. And there was one other possibility we'll come to. One possibility was a huge surge in corporate investment. I'm talking in the private sector. So let's focus on the private sector. But the corporate sector wasn't going to go out and invest in the middle of a huge slump. They were as frightened as everybody else. So they stopped investing. That made it even worse. The other alternative was a huge expansion in net exports, a real export boom. There was an improvement in net exports in a number of countries. But, of course, the rest of the world was also hit. And the rest of the world was very unwilling to pursue even more expansionary policies than it did. China did to some extent, but they got into difficulties as a result. When you go through these options, you're left with only one other player, the government. And I argued very strongly against many pessimists from 2008-09 onwards that the US, UK, certainly it's more questionable in the Eurozone because of the defects of the Eurozone as a structure. The US and the UK were very well situated to borrow more. Their governments were solvent, that they will be able to borrow quite cheaply. This wasn't just about QE because there were no other good borrowers. That because it was going to be so cheap to borrow, that made the increase in debt relatively unworrying. After all, the interest rate matters too. And therefore, the government had to come forward and take up the weight of the deficiency of demand at that time. And for many more years, I didn't know how long, but certainly for substantial years. In addition, there had to be a lot of debt restructuring, and I'm strongly in favor of doing more than having done more than we did. But unfortunately, after a couple of years, 2009-2010, when Western governments did pursue that policy, then they started tightening again. And they tightened too soon, They tighten for various reasons. Every country's politics are a bit different. But the net effect is that the government stopped being a net contributor to demand and started withdrawing it. Fortunately, in the US, the aggressive policy of the Fed, which I support, the QE 2 and 3, as it were, sustained some demand in the private sector, though it creates some worries as well. Elsewhere, that didn't happen to the same degree. A bit more in the UK, which has finally come through. But my view is this was a balance sheet recession. It wasn't just a temporary event. People thought it was going to be short term. On the contrary, it was going to be a long term event. We needed a policy to deal with balance sheet recessions, which were going to last many years. And I think that was something that most of the economists advising the president in the US missed, unfortunately. And the result is we have had a much weaker recovery than we need to. And that feeds on itself, because if the recovery is very weak, why should the corporate sector go and invest? What's the reason to take the risk of investing if you don't think demand's going to grow very much? It doesn't make sense. So I think that was a very big mistake, and certainly not the only one, but it's one of the reasons the recovery has been so disappointing, and that we feel we're in this malaise almost everywhere, from which we haven't escaped, and which I mentioned at the beginning of our discussion.
And you touched on something that was critical a moment ago, which was the political aspect of this, because in many ways it was responding to this crisis in the context of a pretty fragile system that existed, and having to respond in addition to the political demands that were being put upon that fragile system, as well as the economic demands. I mean, an example of that, you talk about the response of the central banks, and in many ways you were impressed by the immediate response in 2008. And yet, although the response initially was very robust, everybody became very timid afterwards.
Yes, I think this is right. There are several things going on here, which I think are very, very important. First, for very significant reasons, in a number of countries, and I think the US is clearly the most important because it's the most important country, politics was becoming really quite febrile, feverish, even before the crisis. And that's pretty obvious. Decline in confidence in politicians, a decline in confidence in ability of government to do anything sensible, and deep political divisions. Then the crisis comes along. The crisis makes people, all crises like this, frightened and angry. And they're entitled to feel angry and frightened. They don't understand why it's happened. It's a very, very complicated event, very difficult to disentangle what's been driving it. When you have frightened and angry people, don't blame people, it seems to me almost inevitable, they will start looking for conspiracies. They will start thinking somebody's cheating them. And in this case, they were right. People were cheating them, no doubt. The anger of, say, Mr. Rick Santelli was focused on the saps who bought houses who shouldn't, rather than the people who lent them to them and the financial institutions that were behind them, has never been completely clear to me. But nonetheless, they felt they were taken for a ride, and they want somebody to be punished, and they're very angry, and that's very divisive. So it's a second very, very big factor. You can see that everywhere. And then the third thing that happens is that crises are very rare events. Like something like this hasn't happened since the 30s. I think, though this is not universally accepted, but I believe it is a fundamental principle in economics, that in a crisis of this kind, you have to do things rather as an emergency ward would dealing with a fatal, a patient who's almost dying. You have to do some extraordinary things you would never normally do. Like in the case of a patient you would never give huge electric shocks to a normal person who's healthy. You would only do it to somebody whose heart has stopped. So you have to pursue policies in an extreme crisis which look insane, which look wild, which look irresponsible, huge fiscal deficits, massive expansion of the balance sheet of the central bank, radical restructurings of debt. All these things are necessary in a crisis, which in normal times you would think rightly are anathema. And of course, if the government starts going even a bit in this direction, people will say, whoa, this is the end of civilization. This is not how decent people behave. This is irresponsible. There's going to be hyperinflation tomorrow. You're bailing out crooks and all the rest of it. And bailing out financial systems in extreme panics is, I'm afraid, necessary. So the political backlash builds in, and political entrepreneurs and political politicians or entrepreneurs like anybody else exploit that. And you can see the backlash in the US, say, with the midterms in 2010, and in the UK with the new government that came into power in April 2010. You can see it in the policies imposed by Germany and Germans who were so anxious about these irresponsible policies in Europe. And the net result was that after 2 years of actually quite modest experiments, not adequate in my view, basically everything went into reverse and people wanted to go back to the old conventional ways. But unfortunately, they didn't go back too fast. It wasn't as bad as the 30s, thank heavens. We didn't allow the complete collapse of the financial system, though there were some people, believe it or not, who recommended that we should go through the whole experience of the 30s. But we didn't do that nonetheless. In my view, the policy was not radical enough and sustained long enough that undermined the speed of the recovery. Now, none of this means that I think that every firm should be saved. On the contrary, there were a lot of big mistakes and there had to be a lot of bankruptcy in the system, but that has to be done in a managed way. Unfortunately, for the reasons I've suggested, the bitterness before already there, the anger at the time, all quite understandably, and finally the fear over these new unconventional policies, all that amount led ultimately, as you've mentioned, to policy paralysis, and worse than policy paralysis. I mean, look at the extraordinary debates in the US over whether you should raise the debt ceiling or actually default. I mean, it's also almost surreal. So in most countries, it's by no means limited to the US, really quite big policy mistakes on this side were made. And the result, I think, is visible in this incredibly weak, very disappointing, very painful recovery.
The global nature of some of these economic issues is clearly, as you've suggested, part of the underlying problem. As we look at solutions, and you lay out many proposals, we obviously don't have time to get into too many of them, but is the solution equally global? Do we need to be looking at these solutions on a global basis, or is it really a country-by-country situation at this point?
Well, my argument is, in this essence, it's both, which is, I'm afraid, disappointing, though I actually think most of what needs to be done can be done by countries, certainly by big ones like the US. I mean, if you're Greece, you don't have much choice. Really, you have none. But a country like the US, there isn't any other, has a pretty fair degree of freedom if it's prepared to be radical enough. But to give you some idea of the global aspect of this, it does seem to me, for example, that the pattern we saw before the crisis, in which emerging countries, which had most of the best investment opportunities, were exporting their surplus savings to the developed countries, which clearly didn't know what to do with them, that's a fundamentally unsustainable and undesirable way of running the whole world economic system. So we need a system, and I discuss it, to encourage savings to go the other way. If we're going to encourage more savings, which means more investment in emerging countries where there are more better opportunities, then we need reforms in those countries and we need a better insurance system against financial crises. Because one of the reasons these countries are so nervous about opening up to inflows of foreign capital is that in the past, every time that they've done that, they've ended up in crises. So that's one important area. Then I think the issues are come to the financial sector. As long as we've got an integrated financial sector with financial institutions that operate more or less across the world, then it's very difficult to think of a set of fixes that don't involve global cooperation. You're not going to get away with completely different rules and regulations, in at least in the major countries where the major institutions are headquartered. So the impulse towards a high degree of global cooperation on the financial sector rules is, I think, more or less an inevitable consequence of having a global financial system. You could imagine moving away from such a system, but that will be immensely radical and controversial. But it seems to me there are other areas where we have much room for maneuver. Say, again, take the US. I've suggested that one of the things we could have done is use the ability of the central bank to create money more directly to fund government spending or government tax cuts. This was once called helicopter money by Milton Friedman, of all people, who said it, there were circumstances in which it made sense. It was perfectly possible in theory for states to do that. I think it's perfectly possible to move in the directions I've suggested in making parts of the banking sector at least safer, though that would have some difficulties on the international side, but I think probably manageable ones. And then if you think about income distribution, well, which I think has become a big issue, well, you know, it's clear that the income distribution, the rise in income inequality has differed across countries very considerably and has been very extreme in the US. I mean, and in the UK to a lesser degree. Now, I think our countries, I certainly am not arguing in any way for equality, but I think the degree of increases in inequality is excessive and actually economically damaging. I think that's more widely accepted now among economists, not universally. And I think the US, for example, could perfectly well have a set of fiscal policies, a set of policies that reduce that. And I think it would be good for the US, although I'm not an American, I shouldn't go too far on that. But those are things the US could certainly do on its own. It taxes its citizens worldwide. It could reform its corporation tax system quite easily. So I would say there are things we need to do globally, but there are also some very important things we can do, as it were, nationally and locally. And I wouldn't want to suggest that because it's so difficult to do things globally, that we should just sit on our hands and do nothing. And I think that's particularly true for obvious reasons for the U.S.
Martin Wolf, his book is The Shifts and the Shocks, What We've Learned and Have Still to Learn from the Financial Crisis. Martin, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
That was a real pleasure.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.